This is Remembrance Sunday, a day when services are held all over the United Kingdom to commemorate the contribution of British and Commonwealth, military and civilian servicemen and women in all conflicts since the First World War. As always, we remember those who have paid the ultimate sacrifice in laying down their lives in service for their country, and we pray especially for all who remain casualties of war, whose lives will never be the same again. But today is a programme special, which recognises what is the 100th anniversary of the signing of the armistice at the end of World War I, by way of the second part of an interview with Alan Fidler, Chief Coordinator of the Northumbria World War I Centenary Project. Last week, Alan told us all about the project itself, but this week, he'll be telling us about his reflections and opinions about what has since been named the Great War.
And up to the troubles in your old kit bag, and smile, smile, smile. While you look about to light your bag, smile, boys, that's the style. What the use of worrying? It never was worthwhile. So, act up your troubles in your own kit bag and smile, smile, smile.
Alan, I want to read a quote from an item on the subject of World War from a newspaper I once read. It said this: at the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, the guns fell silent on the Western Front to bring an end to the First World War. This was supposed to be the war to end all wars. It brought about the wholesale slaughter of tens of thousands of fine men, all for the sake of a few yards of muddy ground. Never was there such a case of human folly and madness. Generals sitting well back from the field of action, with callous disregard for human life, sent row upon row of men over the top into action against German machine guns, which simply mowed them down. There were those who survived and lived to tell the tale, but they were never the same on their return, gaunt, haggard and shell-shocked, and suffering from gas inhalation, old men before their time. Does this sum up accurately the kind of war it really was?
Well, I have to take to task the whole view that this war was conducted by uncaring generals who were sitting back miles behind the line, not giving a fig for the number of men who were being killed. There are legion examples of senior commanders who were at the front and killed with their men, probably contrary to instruction that they shouldn't put themselves in danger simply because their technical and military experience was more valuable to have them in the headquarters than to have them getting themselves killed at the front. But several men, famous generals, were killed from the northeast of England. General Riddle was killed on the 26th of April 1950 at the Battle of St Julian, leading his men. Other generals, General Ingeville Williams, who commanded the 34th Division on the Somme, which was principally composed of the Tyneside Irish, Tyneside Scottish brigades, who suffered horrendous casualties undoubtedly on the 1st of July 1916. Ingeville Williams himself was killed by German shellfire inspecting the front lines on the 21st of July. So the idea that these men were uncaring of their men's lives is just a myth.
Mm. It does go back through history, doesn't it, that the generals did sit on their horses and send the men in, though, in all kinds of battles in English history. Is that not the style of it all?
Well, no, the concept of British filmography of the Battle of Waterloo with Napoleon on the top of one hill with a spyglass at his eye and Wellington on the other side of the valley with looking at his men through a spyglass as they have a scrap in an area the size of a football pitch is obviously nothing to do with the concept of how the First World War was fought along a 600-mile front on the Western Front in France and Belgium. And battles such as the Battle of the Somme was a campaign which opened on the 1st of July along 20 miles of front with 120,000 men going into action. And although the 1st of July was undoubtedly the greatest disaster for the British Army in terms of the number of casualties of men killed in what turned out to be a fairly impossible task, of attritional warfare, seeking to drive a wedge through very heavily defended German lines, which had not been reduced to the shambles that it was imagined they would be by 7 days of intense artillery bombardment. There were undoubted successes on some parts of the line, and by the time the campaign comes to an end on the 18th of November of 1916, and although they've barely and haven't actually achieved the destination intended for the first day, the town of Bapaume, the Germans have suffered horrendous casualties as well, and the German army in the winter of 1917 withdraws to the Hindenburg line, and on the view that it could no longer sustain another campaign such as it had suffered in the Somme campaign of 1916. So they were achieving things at enormous cost, and yes, today it looks like absolute slaughter and a waste of lives, and in many ways it was, but they had no alternative strategy that they could work out for themselves other than full frontal attacks.
But in that particular battle of the Somme, how many died in a few days?
Well, the campaign lasts right through to November the 18th, on the 1st of July. Total British casualties are numbered around 400,000, killed, wounded and taken prisoner, and the missing. The casualties on the first day, 19,000 killed, another 37,000 wounded, are the worst casualties the British Army has ever had inflicted on it in a single day. But they learned rapidly from what they were doing, and they learned as they went along at the campaign at Arras in 1917, and subsequently in the probably the most notorious bloodbath of the war, Passchendaele. Or in fact, the total casualties at Passchendaele weren't as bad as other campaigns. It was just the horrendous conditions in which the men were being required to fight. Mm. One could have argued that the campaign should have been stopped because of the weather, but you know, you plan a campaign with objectives and the weather gets in the way.
But these are horrendous numbers, aren't they? As a teacher, I would often have to settle an argument in the playground and ask children, who started it? What brought this about? But I've read about World War One, and it seems to me that it was an Austrian, Hungarian, Serbian problem. What on earth did we have to get involved for? How did it all start, in your opinion?
Well, you can take the view that the whole thing started because of the failure of the political system and alliances and structures of Western Europe at the time, and including Russia, the Russian Empire, didn't find a way to negotiate out of the problem. It was the fact that there were pre-existing power blocks in Europe. Russia and France were allied, Germany and Austria-Hungary, Austria-Hungarian Empire, and Turkey were allied, the Central Powers. These people had formed these alliances over many years, and it became difficult for them to mediate problems outside of the power blocks of influence. Britain was on the sidelines with the Entente with France, Entente Cordiale, but that didn't commit us automatically to support France. We came into the war in response to the German attack of Belgium, which we were guaranteeing its neutrality with the Treaty of London of 1839. There is a view that, in fact, it was all about maintenance of power blocks and imperial influence. Germany wanted to have an empire elsewhere in the world. Britain, France, Portugal had carved up Africa ahead of the Germans. They wanted, the Kaiser wanted his place in the sun. You can see for all of these sort of broader reasons as to why, when the Austrian Grand Archduke Franz Ferdinand and his wife were assassinated by a Bosnian nationalist in Sarajevo, that inevitably, as it's parodied in Oh What a Lovely War, the dominoes fall as each country attacks another country, so their friend comes in to support them and their friend comes in to support them. So it's a diplomatic failure which leads to the war, but it's very complex reasons of economic power and power balances in Europe that caused the war to take place.
So it's almost like having a little bit of a touch paper to set it all in motion, and that assassination was perhaps the touch paper to the powder keg going off.
Well, the idea that Britain woke up on the 5th of August, so the British population woke up and said, oh dear me, we're at war, what a surprise. It's a complete mythology, because the British Army had highly developed plans for mobilisation in order to support the French in what we thought would be a war on the European mainland, and where we were likely to be supporting the French against the presumed enemy of Germany, although we had diplomatic relations with all of these countries. And of course, as most people know, King George V, the Tsar of Russia, and the Kaiser were all first cousins.
Mm. The Germans were very organised as well. They had built up a lot of armaments, hadn't they?
Well, both France and Germany, unlike Britain, had large standing armies, and they had conscription of young men before the First World War, so that they had large reserves of young men and adult males right through the age of their 40s who had had some military training, compulsory military training. Britain had no such scheme. We had a small army of 250,000 men, half of whom were engaged in holding down the British Empire in India, the Caribbean and Africa, essentially little more than a colonial police force. We relied on a huge navy, much bigger than the army at that time, to maintain Britain's command of the seas, because we were a trading nation. We were dependent on free passage in the seas to support the huge British industrial empire, British economy, which was built upon manufacturing. We weren't a country which could even feed itself in 1914. So the small army in Britain, those parts of the army not engaged on colonial duties, half of the army was held in Britain as a putative expeditionary force to go to the continent in the event of a war, and it was mobilised very rapidly, such that when the German troops met British troops at Mons on the 21st and 22nd of August, they were absolutely astounded. They couldn't think that how could Britain possibly have put an army in the field. But the army we put in the field was 120,000 strong. That's all we had available. We were rapidly bringing reservists back from their homes, people who'd signed on, had finished their service with the colours and had to do 7 years on the reserve. These men, some of whom hadn't been in uniform for many years, but a territorial force which had only been formed as it in its form at that time in 1908, which was purely intended for home defence. It was not intended for men to go overseas in the territorial force, although many did sign the Imperial Service Obligation, which said they would go overseas. So the parties involved in the war were on vastly different sides. Britain was of no great significance at the beginning of the war in terms of its armed contribution to the war.
But the carnage that was to follow the outbreak of the war was unforeseen, wasn't it? Everyone expected to be home by Christmas. How did it go on for so long in such a limited space?
Well, again, it'll all be over by Christmas. It was not the view of Lord Kitchener, who was the great colonial hero of Omdurman and became the Minister for War, a civilian post, not a military post, on the 5th of August. And he told the War Cabinet that he needed an additional army of 1 million men. And you can imagine the politicians' reaction to saying they want a million further men, and we've got an army of 250,000, the minute half of whom are in the colonies. You must be mad. But he said, no, this war will go on for a long time. He never thought it would be over by Christmas, and he was proved to be right. And by the end of the first Battle of Ypres, when the British Army had moved from France up into Belgium to defend the front line near the Channel ports and near the town of Ypres, the British Expeditionary Force had essentially almost been destroyed.
Can you tell me about the General's fury at that truce on the first Christmas Day, where German soldiers and British soldiers came together? The generals were really annoyed, were they not?
Well, it was after the event that they were annoyed. Truces were not unknown on both sides to allow the burial of the dead, the recovery of the wounded, etc. Throughout military fighting. And the winter had set in, there was no active fighting going on. And the evidence suggests that, you know, some German soldiers started singing Heilige Nacht, Holy Night, British soldiers singing carols, and on the morning one or two waved a white flag and advanced across no man's land, and they met up and shook hands. And there are some good pictures of Northumberland Hussars officers, the first yeomanry cavalry out to France, meeting with their German counterparts.
And a football match?
The idea that there was some sort of Premier League fixture list running down 600 miles of a front line is total mythology. And the man who advised Sainsbury's on their famous advert that was run in the Christmas period of 2014, and I spoke with him personally, said that until he found two bits of separate corroborated evidence from both sides of the line that some sort of a football game had taken place, he wasn't prepared to go through with advising Sainsbury's on it. But any game of football which might have been played would have been a bit of kick and push with a couple of greatcoats on a shell pot area of no man's land. The idea that they had football pitches and referees running up and down is just crazy. And of course the whole thing became mythologized because it appealed to the whole thing of the idea of the national game. There's a statue in Liverpool of two soldiers shitting hands over a football. The whole thing is just blown out of all proportion. There may well have been there was fraternisation, and of course the next day some units refused to engage in any action against the men opposite them, which infuriated the officers on both sides, they made it quite clear that there would be no future example to this sort of fraternisation. Okay. By the time Christmas 1915 arises, we've been through two bloody battles at Ypres and Loos, and there's little or no inclination to have any fraternisation with the enemy.
Again. It does seem to be a special moment, though. But what seems horrific to me in war is the need to invent new and more sophisticated weapons. And way back in World War One, it was poison gas, the grenade, the flamethrower, the machine guns, the tanks and torpedoes, under the ground, battlements as well, digging tunnels. The injuries of those who did return must have had a terrible knock-on effect in how a soldier's family survived due to his disability as well. Were they dealt with fairly? And many would say we need to care far more for our veterans today in the light of even more sophisticated weapons.
Well, the scale of the fighting in the First World, of course, was way beyond anything the British Army had fought in the past. We hadn't fought any sort of a war since the Crimean War, which was still fought with guns where you pushed a ball down the mouth of the gun and the else. Our great Lord Armstrong invented the breech-loading gun. The refinement of artillery and the means to kill people, the development of the machine gun, led to horrendous injuries and life-threatening and permanently disabling injuries in vast numbers during the First World War. But there wasn't the technologies that we have today to save people or to ameliorate a lot of these injuries. Gas had been introduced by the Germans in the First World War. It was prohibited under certain treaties and conventions, but to be honest, as soon as the Germans started to use it, we very rapidly developed the power to send gas over ourselves. Mm-hmm. Because the problem with gas was that it was more a weapon of terror than a weapon of great effect. But men were suffering the effects of gas for many years after the war. Chest complaints, particularly those who'd suffered from mustard gas, a hideous, hideous weapon, which fortunately was not employed in the Second World War, probably because both sides realised that the damage was equally caused to both yourselves and your enemy in equal measure and served no strategic purpose.
And bombs coming from the sky for the first time.
Well, bombing was developed in the First World War, but the war came to an end before the development of large-scale bombing. That the German Gotha bombers inflicted a lot of damage in London and had the German military arsenal and manufacturing capability there to expand those operations at the back end of the First World War. There might have been far more deaths in London and the south coast area than there were. Bombers weren't a threat to the northeast of England because they didn't have the range at that time to cross the North Sea, vast distance. It was easier to attack the southeast of England.
But added to all of this death in war, though, we have the death from disease, prisoners of war camp, flu epidemics too, to add to the numbers.
Well, the war was notorious for injuries. 59% of war injuries were caused by artillery fire, shrapnel ball and shards of hot metal from shells exploding, gas. But the problem in the war was there was little or no antisepsis. Blood transfusion was in its infancy. And if you were wounded in the torso, not so much in the arms or legs where they could affect amputation, it was almost certain death. By the Second World War, we have antibiotics and the whole situation changes around. So where 80% of certain types of injury would have caused death in the First War, you get 80% of recovery in the Second World War. So the and disease and maintaining hygiene at the front was, it was a constant problem. They're in horrible conditions, poor diet. Although the they did get rations, probably better than the population in some respects. But it was a monotonous diet, which was ungood for them. And the diseases of the trenches, the lice, the trench foot, any exploding shells, the ground saturated and it's full of animal droppings and waste from all the horses that are out there. You get gas gangrene, so wounds often develop into an irrecoverable situation. This is not, that type of warfare is not conducted in the Second World War, so it's not the same type of warfare either. So the deaths, prisoners of war are not well treated, but not grossly badly treated on both sides. Certainly on the British prison, the German prisoners taken by the British are reported by the Germans to have been reasonably well treated.
And the terror of the mud as well, you know, falling off a platform. The mud sucking
down. Well, yes, in the Passchendaele, there were men who were drowned simply in the mud if you fell off the duckboards, and your comrades were ordered not to attempt to save you because they were to carry on marching forward, and in any case, if they attempted to rescue you, they might end up in the same mire that you were in, and they would also drown. Horrendous. I mean, I have a collection of archive material from two men from North Shields. One of them describes the conditions up at Huttold Forest in the Passchendaele battle, and it's just hard to comprehend how men could physically continue to endure those sort of conditions day after day.
I've just been finishing a book by a man called Martin Gilbert on the Holocaust, and the number of times I've wanted to put it down because it was so horrendous. Did your research on this project of World War One affect you in a similar way?
Well, no, I didn't actually do any of the research, but I did. So you reflect on the numbers that have been killed from various communities and streets in the town, whatever else, but it doesn't have that impact with me, because although the deaths were individually sad, there isn't the mendacity which you would associate with the Holocaust, where it was an organised attempt to eradicate people for grounds of spurious racial or ethnic identity. It wasn't a war like that, particularly in the First World War, although there's the old story about the Germans singing the hymn of hate, that we hate the British and we hate the English, and that this is the idea that they had a view of dislike for each other. But towards the end of the war, the two armies which probably had the most respect for each other were the British and French, British and German armies.
I haven't been able to find a consistent total number of military and civilian casualties in World War One. The estimates vary so much. Could you tell me which countries were the worst hit? What was the breakdown of numbers?
Well, there's plenty of books with statistics. A good book for statistics with numbers is a book called Mud, Blood and Poppycock. Where it analyses a lot of the statistics and shows that a lot of the myths are just that, myths. But in pro rata to their total populations, Bulgaria and Serbia suffer probably the worst per capita death rates, and then the Russians and the Germans don't come out very well on it. The British death rate isn't so bad pro rata to the total population. We have 888,000 recorded British war deaths. I think that's the military deaths, excludes the civilians and the merchant navy, etc., from a population of about 39 million for Great Britain at the outbreak of the war. But the Scots claim that per capita Scotland suffered a greater death rate than the rest of the UK home nations. But you have to remember that after 1916, that there was no geographical recruitment into county regiments, etc. There was a deliberate policy after the slaughter on the Somme. The army diluted county formations and national units by randomly allocating new conscripts to units irrespective of where they actually came from by place of birth. So looking at the figures doesn't get you very far in terms of finding out hard information.
Okay. Just one last question before you leave us, Alan. Is there any way our so-called civilised world can avoid war in the future? What lessons do you think we should learn from the past?
Well, I hope we already have learned lessons. I think we've had a period of peace since 1945. And although we have antagonistic relations between nations, I think even when you look at the situation between the Soviet Union as it was, now Russia, these people, these nations suffered such horrendous losses. I think there is not an appetite for a major conflict to break out again. And I hope that people, having had the experience in two generations, even my parents went through, that my parents went through, I've had 7 years of peace. Although it would be true to say that I lived through the 50s and 60s with the apparent threat of nuclear annihilation, we have come through and hopefully lessons have been learned.
I do hope you're right, Alan. And I'd just like to thank you most sincerely for your time and for sharing your reflections on the huge amount of World War material you and your volunteers have put together. It seems to have generated such a lot of interest and been such a worthwhile project. Thank you once again. For those of you who missed the name of our special guest today, I've been talking with Alan Fidler, Chief Coordinator of the Northumbrian Commemorative Project, which marks the centenary of the signing of the armistice at the end of World War I. And now to close our programme, we have the familiar sound of a lone bugler playing the last post, which brings to our minds this day the memory of generations of the fallen. They shall not grow old as we that are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn. At the going down of the sun and in the morning, we will remember them.